Position number 2179, wheel 4.
Mr. Frank Cottam, wheel 4. 2 days ago, June 25th, was the 51st anniversary of the invasion of North Korea into South Korea, so it's a very appropriate time to continue with your recall and take up from the momentous time of joining the First Gloucesters.
I mentioned earlier that ever since 1801, when the Gloucesters earned the right to wear cap badges at the back and the front, having fought back to back against the French, and seem to have done it on something similar on several occasions since then, that they'd formed this habit of getting themselves surrounded and fighting back to back. So this is the regiment I was posted to from Japan in early 1951. And in April of 51, we were, the platoon I was with, two platoon of A Company, was sitting on top of a very flat-topped, steep-sided hill, which because of its shape and size, we used to know as Castle Hill or Castle Site. The way the battalion was deployed, A Company was the most forward company, and my platoon was the most forward platoon of A Company. We were overlooking the Imjin River and lying astride the route traditionally taken by invaders coming out of Asia and heading down the Korean Peninsula towards the ancient capital of Seoul. And at about 10 o'clock, 10:30 maybe, on the night of Sunday the 22nd of April, the Chinese swarmed over the Imjin River in the start of an offensive that was designed to sweep all before it and capture Seoul within about 48 hours. But they reckoned without this irritating habit of the Gloucesters. We'd been warned that day to expect patrols in strength during the night. Some patrol. We found out later that there were three Chinese divisions, each about 9,000 strong, were thrown against our brigade front. And we must have mauled them pretty badly, because after the Imjin battle, none of those three divisions was ever seen in action again during the Korean War. Well, you know what they say, when you've had one Chinese division, an hour later, you want another. Or is that a Chinese takeaway? I spent most of that Sunday afternoon rigging up 16 trip players round three sides of the platoon position. And at dusk, the CO, Colonel Kahn, sent an ambush patrol from the carrier platoon and some lads from C Company, the reserve company, down by the river near a spot which we used to call Gloucester Crossing, a rather shallow ford. When the Chinese first started to cross, the ambush patrol held them up for about half an hour or so and then had to pull back because they were running out of ammunition. And my platoon was the next to get hit, sometime shortly before midnight. We held them all that night, during which they set off 15 out of these 16 trip flares, and they were all within a distance we could reach by throwing grenades. However, sometime just after first light, they managed to get a lodgment in a bunker at one end of the platoon position, just outside of the platoon perimeter. I had wanted to fill this bunker in when we first took the position over from the Americans, because I could see it could be a potential problem. But I was told to leave it alone because General Ridgway at some time was coming up to look over the battlefront from that bunker. Why the hell he couldn't look over it from one of our foxholes, or even standing up on the top of the hill as we did most of the time, I don't know. But the bunker had to be left there, and so I'd strung a barbed wire fence, what we used to call a double apron fence, across the top of the hill between our right-hand section and the bunker. When the Chinese got in there, we cleared them out once with a couple of bombs from a rocket launcher. But within about half an hour or so, they were back in there. And the reserve platoon commander, a fellow called Curtis, Lieutenant Curtis, came forward with some of his lads to help us clear them out again. And in the process, he won the VC, but lost his life. As they approached the bunker, they set off the last of my trip flares, and they didn't know, they didn't realise what it was, and they probably thought it was something nasty coming from the direction of the bunker. And they ran back a few yards, and at that moment, Curtis got hit in the backside with shots from the bunker, and he went down. It wasn't a serious wound, it wasn't life-threatening. And his lads wanted him to stay down while the medics patched him up, but he lost his rag completely. He got up and he charged the bunker on his own, and whoever was in the bunker cut him down shortly before he got there, which is, you know, how he came to win the VC. What happened next was that a medic, a lad who died earlier this year actually, a fellow called Papworth, Corporal Papworth, came forward with a stretcher. He threw the stretcher over the wire, went through the gap that I'd left in the middle of the wire, went up to Curtis's body, got it on a stretcher and dragged him round the wire and back. He was dead by this time, of course. Now, that was one of the most brave things I think I've ever seen. He was wearing a Red Cross, but he had no way of knowing whether the Chinese would recognise it, whether, if they recognised it, they would honour it, or, you know, whether they would just open up on him. And in my book, he's the fella who should have had the VC. He actually won the military medal. But what he did, I thought, was extremely brave. About an hour after that, we were driven from the top of the hill by sheer weight of numbers, and we pulled back to a lower part of the feature where the company headquarters and the reserve platoon had foxholes. We called for the carriers and the Korean porters to bring up more ammunition with the intention of counterattacking and retaking the flat top of the hill, but it didn't work out quite that way. Shortly after we'd pulled back, my platoon commander was killed. That was two out of the three platoon commanders in A Company gone, and about half an hour after that, the company commander was killed.
What were their names?
The platoon commander was a fellow called John Maycock, and the company commander was Major Pat Angier. That left us with one young second lieutenant, the only officer left, a fellow called Terry Waters, and he was badly wounded later on and died in captivity. So for most of the Imjin battle, A Company, all the platoons in A Company, were commanded by platoon sergeants. Now, there's nothing unique or unusual about that. In a rifle company in action, it's fairly frequent for platoon sergeants to find themselves acting as platoon commanders. The reason for that is that these young officers, second lieutenants they used to send us, had a flair for being in the wrong place at the wrong time when the flak was flying, and they didn't last very long. I used to put it down to an excess of youthful exuberance and a total lack of battle experience. And it used to be a bit of a standing joke in the sergeant's mess that they made them second lieutenants because they were too young and insufficiently trained to be private soldiers. However, to be fair, those who survived their usual, the first one or two engagements with the enemy usually went on to become quite good officers. In the front line, you learn quick or you don't learn at all. Sometime after that, we were ordered to the whole of A Company to pull back completely because we were in danger of repeating the old Gloucester trick of getting ourselves surrounded. So we pulled back across the floor of the valley and took up new positions on Hill 235. And that was on the around about the middle of the Monday morning, the 23rd of April. The Northumberland Fusiliers, who were on our right, were attacked also at around about the same time and were steadily pushed back during the day, and that must have pleased them no end, because April the 23rd, St George's Day, is their regimental day, so not a good time to be chased by the Chinks for them. On our left, the Rocks, or OKs, Republic of Korea troops, South Koreans, scuttled back almost as soon as the Chinese hit them, and the Gloucesters, true to tradition, or maybe just force of habit, stayed put and were gradually surrounded. Although during that day, all the companies had to give up significant amounts of ground and also suffered fairly large numbers of casualties. Until by Tuesday morning, the entire battalion, or what was left of us, were concentrated in a fairly tight perimeter on Hill 235. And that's the hill that ever since has been known as Gloucester Hill. We received various pieces of information and instructions during the course of that Tuesday. Initially, we were told it was necessary that we stay put where we are. And since we were well and truly surrounded by then, I'm not quite sure what else they thought we might do. Then we were told that a relief column from the Centurion tanks from the 8th Hussars with some Filipino infantry were on the way, and when they got to us, we should withdraw along with that relief column. The next information we got was that the relief column was highly unlikely to get through to us that day, but they would supply us, resupply us by air. And a couple of planes came over and dropped some stuff to us, mostly extra brain guns and cases of 303 ammunition. But since we were on a fairly razor-backed hill, most of it hit the top of the hill and bounced down the sides, where the Chinese picked it up, said thank you very much, and used it against us. Then we were told that the following morning we would be resupplied from what we used to call a flying boxcar, presumably so we'd have enough ammunition and weapons to fight our way back with the relief column when it arrived. During the course of Tuesday night, we were kept extremely busy, mostly listening to a Chinese bugle recital. The Chinese in those days, like the British Army used to do, used bugle calls for almost everything. And every time we heard the bugles playing, we knew another attack was coming in. Sometime around about first light the next morning, it was suggested by the adjutant that the drum major should sound off on his bugle as an answer to the Chinese bugles and to raise the morale of the battalion. The adjutant was a captain named Farah Hockley, now a retired general. Most people will have heard of him. Until recently, almost any time there's anything happened, any trouble anywhere in the world, the press and TV seemed to call in Farah Hockley to give an expert military opinion. It got so that I used to judge the seriousness of a situation by two things. One, is Kate Adie there? And two, have they asked Farah Hockley to comment? But he was an extremely brave man and an extremely good soldier. And there's little doubt that if the lads in the battalion had ever been asked or allowed to vote on the allocation of medals, he would have been almost certainly at the top or near the top for a VC. As it was, he was awarded a DSO. But there's something of a legend growing up around this bugle playing instrument. According to the legend, the drum major, who always had his bugle with him, stood rigidly to attention on the top of the hill, sounded the long reveille, and a great cheer went up from the battalion. Now that's the legend, and that's the legend that was repeated in the drum major's Not autobiography. When he died, what's the word?
Biography.
You get him in the Telegraph every day.
Obituary,
thank you. Yeah, that's the legend that was repeated in the obituary that the Telegraph published when he died a few years ago. It wasn't quite like that. He didn't draw out his bugle that he always had with him. He didn't have a bugle. He borrowed one from one of the drummers, corps of drums, a lad called Tony Eagles. He didn't stand to attention on the top of the hill. He was a big fella, well over 6 foot. And if he'd have stood up there skylined, he wouldn't have lasted very long. He stood down from the summit of the hill under a scrub oak where the Chinese would have difficulty spotting him. And if a great cheer went up from the battalion, well, I never heard it. I heard a few ribald remarks and suggestions about what he might do with this bugle. After all, this was Wednesday morning. We'd had no sleep since Saturday night, with the exception of a few catnaps in between shooing off the Chinese. And this guy's blowing the reveille. So you can imagine what the brutal and licentious soldiery thought and said about that. Anyway, that's actually what happened with the bugle call. A little later, the flying boxcar came over, but by then we were too busy to take delivery of anything except Chinese, and it had to go away again. Then I remember a helicopter came over, which we were told contained Tom Brodie, who was the brigade commander. Whether it did or not, I don't know. And the story is that he signalled down and said, well done, only the Gloucesters could have done it. He gave us, told us the relief column wouldn't now be arriving, and gave us permission to try and break out on our own. So there we were. We'd had no sleep since Saturday night. We'd had no food since Monday. We were almost out of water, so much so that a receptacle was passed around by one of my fellow sergeants for those who could to urinate into, to use to keep his Vickers machine gun cool. And I'm told that people in the immediate vicinity of his Vickers, when it started to fire again, thought chemical warfare had broken out. Our radio batteries were almost exhausted, so we were rapidly getting out of touch with everybody. The relief column was now heading back in the opposite direction. The guns of the 45th Field Regiment of the Royal Artillery, which had been supporting us, had come under small arms fire, so they had to hook trails and move back so far and so fast they could no longer help us. So we reckoned there was anything up to 6 or 7 miles depth of Chinese between ourselves and the UN lines, wherever they might be now. And we were almost out of ammunition. We were getting very low on ammunition. So it wasn't a happy position to be in. Although we didn't know it on that Wednesday morning, indeed, no one could have known it at the time, but the battalion had, over the course of 3 days, and 2 VCs, 2 DSOs, 3 military crosses, 8 military medals, 2 DCMs, 6 or 7 BEMs, 40-odd people mentioned in dispatches, and the American Special Unit Citation, which is a presidential award. But if anyone had been able to tell us that on that Wednesday morning, I doubt if there's a man amongst us who wouldn't happily have swapped the lot for a 48-hour pass. We split into, shortly before we tried to leave the hill, the planes came over again and scorched a few Chinese tails with napalm, which gave us a bit of a breathing space and time to sort out what we were going to do. We split into groups, more in hope than expectation, that way some groups might get through. And one actually did. One group led by an officer called Harvey, Captain Harvey, left the hill by the forward slope, made their way round the side of it and headed south down the bed of a stream and actually got back to the UN lines. Although, unfortunately, in their final dash for safety, they were fired on by American tanks, what these days euphemistically is called friendly fire. Some of them were killed, some were wounded and captured, and about two or maybe three dozen actually got through. I was with a group that got about a mile, maybe a mile and a half from the hill, and we went over a ridge and dropped down into a valley, only to find it was jam-packed full of Chinese. We'd walked right into it. There was nothing really we could do. We were heavily outnumbered. We had very little left to fight with. We probably didn't have more than a dozen or so rounds between the lot of us, so there was nothing to do but surrender. We, in fact, were in the bag. Can I take a break there?
Yes.
Okay. Anyone who's had the experience of being captured on the battlefield will know that it's a fairly traumatic experience. One minute you're one of these tough guys running around the countryside with a gun, prepared to blast anyone who gets in your way. And then suddenly, at a stroke, you're stripped, devoid of any power or authority, even over your own movements, and you're totally at the mercy of someone who sticks a gun in your ribs and says, stand up, sit down, do this, do that, go here, go there. And you want to take the gun off him and stick it right where the troops were telling the drum major to stick his bugle a few hours before, but you know you can't, and you have to come to terms with it. I had the feeling that this can't be, this should never happen. We were a first-class British infantry battalion, and yet we've been cut off, carved up and captured by what we'd always thought of and often referred to as a ragtag and bobtail bunch of slope-headed, slant-eyed sods from Shanghai, or words to that effect. But it had happened, and you have to come to terms with it. And as the realisation sank in, I had two thoughts. One was, well, at least I'll get some sleep tonight. And the other one was, these people live on rice. I don't like rice. What am I going to eat? I was wrong on both counts. We didn't get much sleep that night because they kept moving us around from one place to another. I think they were trying to concentrate all the prisoners they captured over the last two or three days into one central point and couldn't quite make up their mind where. And it was many moons before we got any food as acceptable to the Western palate as white rice. And when we did, I found I could eat it quite easily. Within about an hour of being captured, we were addressed by an English-speaking Chinese officer, a commissar, I would guess, who told us we were fortunate to have been liberated, not captured, liberated by the CPV. The CPV was the Chinese People's Volunteers, which is the name they gave to their army in Korea, because they were all volunteers, right down to the last one of about 500,000 of them. They were volunteers, insomuch that they'd been volunteered en masse by their divisional commanders. They were actually CPV, Chinese People's, PLA rather, Chinese People's Liberation Army, which was the Chinese Communist Regular Army. So he told us we were fortunate to have been liberated by the CPV, who operated a lenient treatment policy. Now, I took that as being a flowery Chinese way of saying that they treated prisoners in accordance with the Geneva Convention. It wasn't, and they didn't. He then went on to say that we should study hard and learn the truth, and I had no idea what he meant by that. They kept us for about a week or 8 days in some Korean houses, not very far from where we were captured, packed in like sardines, not allowed to set foot outside except to go to the toilet, and there were no toilets, of course. with very little to eat. We had a few bowls of a concoction the Chinese used to use as frontline rations. It was a sort of powder made up of ground up soya beans and various kind of grains and God knows what else. And you mix it with water, turns it into a paste, and you eat it. If you mix it with cold water, it tastes gritty and not too easy to get down. If you mix it with hot or warm water, it turns into a rather easier paste. It doesn't taste any better, but you can slide it down more easily. And at the end of that time, they roused us out of the huts one evening around about dusk onto the road outside, where we were again addressed in English by a Chinaman, who again told us how fortunate we were to have been liberated from our capitalist masters, that they recognised, they had this lenient treatment policy because they recognised that we were ordinary working class people who had been duped by the American imperialists and the Wall Street monopoly capitalists and their British lackeys and running dogs into taking up arms against the peace-loving peoples of Korea, and that once we realised the truth, we would join the ranks of the peace-loving peoples of the world and struggle against the American imperialists and Wall Street monopoly capitalists and their British lackeys. It was a refrain we were to hear continually over the next 2 years or so. He also told us that we were now going to a POW camp where we should study hard and learn the truth. The truth being this gospel according to Mao Zedong about us being duped by the American capitalists, etc. He told us we were going to a POW camp. What he didn't tell us was that the camps were up on the Yalu River, which was the border between North Korea and China, and that we were going to walk all the way. And we set off there and then that night. From the area of the Imjin where we were captured to that part of the Yalu where the POW camps were is, I would guess, about 200, maybe 250 miles.
Did you have concept of that then?
No, we didn't know where we were going. We just knew we were going to a POW camp. So it's about 250 miles as the crow flies. But of course we weren't crows. And Korea is very mountainous. And they didn't want us blocking up the MSR, the main supply routes, the roads, for what they were worth. So we had to walk over these narrow, winding mountain tracks, up mountains, down mountains, round mountains, sometimes around the same one more than once because the Chinese guards or guides had a tendency to get lost. So by the time we reached the POW camp, I estimated that we had walked at least 500 miles and probably quite a little bit more. Before we set off, they split us into squads of about 10 or a dozen and told us to democratically elect a squad leader for each squad. So we held democratic elections, British Army style, which took all of 10 seconds and surprise, surprise, resulted in a senior NCO as the leader of each squad. During the march to the north, we were fed twice a day, morning and evening, and we had three types of food. One was the Chinese frontline rations that I referred to earlier. The second type was sorghum, which is grows on tall stalks and tastes a little bit like barley. And the third type was millet, which in this country we give to budgerigar for breakfast. We used to pick up this food at Chinese ration points along the way in sausage-shaped sacks about a yard long and 7 or 8 inches in diameter. You would just sling it over your shoulder and walk along. And the first part of the journey, the first half of the journey, several weeks, about 3 weeks, we had to walk by night, all night and every night. The Chinese said the reason for that was that if we went by day, we would get shot up by the American planes that were buzzing around. We took that with a very large pinch of salt until one evening we lined up before it was anything like dark or dusk. And sure enough, a Sabre jet came swooping over the hill and strafed the column. That happened twice before we got to a POW camp. And then after we got to a camp, they bombed us. And later on, after information about the location of the POW camps had been exchanged at the peace talks,